This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
The Sportsman's Nation is a 2% for conservation certified business. This means that we donate 1% of our time and 1% of our revenue to conservation. If you want to find out how you or your business can get certified or learn more about the organization, visit fishandwildlife.org.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
Yeah, I saw that post and I was like,
yo.
At what point does the ship get turned around where it's like we start seeing more positive and more educated posts and we see more posts where you can see the guy has a clear understanding of, and not to downplay or to throw shade on people that are just getting into it, but it's just like, you know, first and foremost, it's just, there's a lot of work to be done, and that's why everybody's here on this podcast.
Well, that's what I'm going to say. We're going to start it, we're going to turn around right here this week on the podcast, because what we touched on last week was the start of a new series.
Yeah,
a series on vegetation, and we feel like it's super necessary to go through and break down the different types, classes of vegetation that everyone's going to encounter, no matter if you're in the Southeast or in the North or the Northeast or the Midwest. We're going to try and do our best to break down the different classifications and then go through what they are specifically, how you might encounter them, how you might manage them, what they are good for and what they're not good for. And so this is, let's say, week one of this little podcast series that we've got going on. And we're talking about grasses.
Yeah, I felt it appropriate to start off with grass because it seems like grass is discussed way more than the forbs or shrubs.
Oh, yeah,
and
for sure. It's like you need to put it in its place, right?
Yeah. A little bit. It's almost like it's the most popular that we see.
Yeah, for sure.
And yet, if you ranked it out and you said a field of shrubs, so basically just picture a parking lot. When I say field, I'm just talking about an area. And you say shrubs, and then you go with trees, and then you go with straight grasses, and then you go with straight, like, forbs.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the main ones that we're talking. Those are there four. Any others? So those four, and I would say the
or the, invasives. We do have the invasives. We're gonna do a week of invasives, but
and then the if you took those four areas, I would look at the one of the grass being the least productive in my opinion, because I'd be like, there's no. There's certain animals that would be okay, but there's very little food value from a big picture, a long list of wildlife. So,
specifically, there'd be times of the year where certain animals utilize that way more than other times where they avoid it like the plague.
Yeah. It'd be very feast or famine, I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
The feast would be a very short window of time.
Well, I think to go back to like why people favor grasses so much is – I think that there's almost this, where do you turn to get your information from? And a lot of people, when they're working land, their experiences are on cattle farms, but just farms in general. And there's such a, I don't say over usage, but just a significance placed on grasses when it comes to the agricultural community, whether it be through grazing or whether it be through CRP. And for a lot of hunters, that's where their experiences come from. So it seems like, wow, I need to know so much about all these grasses because they must play a role in the wildlife, and they do play a role.
It's just the definition of the Great Plains. Like, you can watch any old and talk about seas of grass.
They didn't talk about the diverse forbs.
And then you go and look at, like, just the definition of the ecological regions. It'd be the tall grass prairie, the short grass prairie. Like, you automatically just like, well, it's lots of grass. It's dominated by grass.
Grass,
lot of grass, but there's also a long list of other things that are... there's a lot of shrubs that are scattered. There's a lot of forbs, certainly.
When you talk about a savanna... It's just as much a grassland as it is a forest.
Yeah.
But it's like, the word grass is brought into so many discussions.
Yep.
It's like overweighted.
Yeah. You could look at the savanna and say, well, it's grassland, but it's got trees, or it's a forest, but it's got grass.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not as many trees, but there's still trees polka dotted around it. So,
but like side by side comparison, there's so much diversity in the grasslands. You know, some of the richest grasslands in the country aren't far from here. When it comes to like species diversity, they're talking like 60, 70, or 90 plants in a square meter.
Yeah,
and it's like, that's not all grass. Like, there's so many other things that comprise the vast number of species that can be found in that one square meter. And even though it's called a grassland, it's not just grass, and thank goodness it's not. But
thank goodness,
here we are talking about grass today, the first week here of the series, and I think it does paint a really good picture to then go like, okay, here we have an over-significance of grass that is influencing what seems to be a lot of land managers in the wildlife side of things. So we need to like kind of set the bar, set the tone here with grass to start from the bottom, and then we're going to work our way up into larger vegetation and stuff that does play more of a significance. So
before we jump in, though, we got a reminder of our virtual property evaluations.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are available really at any time throughout the year. It is a virtual, interaction between either Adam or I, Kyle, Frank, working with you guys on your property. We share pictures back and forth, go over aerials, and try to just map out, what it is you're trying to achieve on the property and work with you virtually, kind of a one-on-one consultation online.
Absolutely. What's been most popular so far, we've done them across the country already. And typically, the way we first started talking about it was, send us your pictures of your farm, send us the photos from each spot on the farm. We'll go through it in an online chat room, classroom or chat, to where we can see the pictures. Both of us share screens so where we can get a really good feel of what's going on. But it's also for guys who maybe they already have a plan implemented and they just want to hear back from us, or heck, they may already have a local conservationist or a local state biologist come out there and they're just like, I just want to hear your opinion too.
Absolutely.
It's an opportunity for us to kind of voice our opinion, our concerns, yeah. or basically say, you know, this all looks good. Maybe do a few tweaks here and there on that plan. And I believe it puts you headed in the right direction.
So. Yeah, it's a great like sounding board. It doesn't have to be a total, hey, I want you to review the entire property. It's more or less, I've got questions.
Yeah.
Utilize us. That's what we're here for. So if you guys are interested in doing that, please send us an email at info@landandlegacy.tv or hit us up on messaging through Facebook or Instagram. We'd love to help you guys out.
Yeah. So as we kick off and jump into this plant podcast 284, plant ID grasses or whatever you're going to call it, but basically we're devoting the whole podcast to grasses. And we're gonna let's go ahead and start jumping in your
yep.
notes there, Matt.
So really, I think it's first start off with the definition. There are two definitions here, but kind of I like.
Yeah,
parts
I want to hear what you found
them.
As what you like.
So you got one too?
Yeah,
perfect. So I'm gonna read two of them. First one: vegetation consisting of typically short plants with long, narrow leaves, growing wild or cultivated in lawns, pastures, or used as fodder crop. Second, mainly herbaceous plant that constitutes. Grass, which has jointed stems and spikes, small wind pollinated flowers. So I think
okay.
what's
yeah,
important is
I
like the wind pollination and then the structure of long yep. narrow leaves.
I have jointed stems, plant consisting of jointed stems, sheathing leaves and seed like grains.
Yeah.
So
I think all of those, the long narrow leaves, the sheaths, the jointed stems, wind pollinated, that basically, and the grain, you know, yep. head some, for some plants, it's really kind of characteristics of a lot of things that we're going to talk about here today. But really, everyone can identify a grass.
Yeah.
Now.
And you know, it's important to note, neither one of us are botanists.
I
don't even have a degree in wildlife management, if you will. What I guess we'll call this layman's terms of grasses. And that's kind of our whole podcast is layman's terms. So, you know, there's a lot of really in-depth stuff out there, a lot of great research that we follow. But if we can't understand it or figure out how to take that research and put it into real-life land management, then we're going to miss the boat. And so
you bring up a great point. I mean, there are extremely skilled botanists who know far more about plants, physiology and the identification of plants than us.
Yeah.
But what is important is to be able to break down the significance of grasses and just say, hey, you can go deeper than this, but really, if you want to become skilled at managing land for wildlife, this is what you need to know. And that's yeah. what this podcast is going to bring.
It's all 80 grit, baby.
That's it. So there are a lot of ways that you can break down grasses and into different categories. And what we're going to do is kind of start with those and then go into more or less how grasses benefit or don't benefit species such as deer, turkey, and quail. But first and foremost, annuals versus perennials.
Yeah.
People, like, what's one of the Man. First things that you... When you're like trying to manage a grass, like let's say it comes up in a food plot or it's in a field, what's like the first like check when you realize, okay, we need to manage this, that you go through in your head? Because for me, it's like, okay, that's an annual, that's a perennial.
I look at it from a standpoint, like if I see a plant that's not something that I planted or not something I expected, first thing I do is try to figure out if it's native or non-native.
Sure.
And then once I do that, then it's like, let's break this down even more. And that's the next step. Is this a perennial or is this an annual? And the reason I ask that to myself is this something that's just a sign of disturbance that over time is going to filter
just
out?
Just fade away.
Like right. an annual would be. Mm-hmm. Or is this something, a perennial, that I'm going to have to, if I don't take care of it today, I'm going to have to deal with this for years and years.
Totally. And I think that basis of the first question gives people, when they're dealing with grasses, it gets you to like the next step. I don't know if
yeah.
some people are familiar with this term or not, but it's like a dichotomous key. And so when you're going through and trying to identify plants before there was like iNaturalist and stuff,
yeah.
people would use a dichotomous key and you went through the plant characteristics. And it's kind of like a stair step thing
yeah.
to get to a plant. Like
yeah.
that takes me back to college.
Much longer process.
Horrible.
iNaturalist and all these plant snaps and things. They make a lot
Short
of us into
that.
Field botanists pretty
yeah.
quickly.
Very, very quickly. But essentially,
not to downplay field botanists, guys, we love you. Yeah. You guys know way more than we do. Way but more. We can get pretty far along in IDing plants now with technology.
Totally. And enough to make the decisions that need to be made, right?
Yep.
But first and foremost,
kill or thrive.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it.
Annual versus perennial, that gives us the first step of saying what needs to be done. What is the next step to be able to say, hey, we're going to keep this around or we're not? Or this is just a product of the fact that you had a disturbance here, you grazed really hard, and now we've got this growing late summer. And it's an annual, and
this
it's going to
fade out. This field that was a cool season dominant grass, you grazed it very hard during peak time of that base grasses window, and now because you knocked it way back, we've opened it up for other things
dirt to
grow.
Here's some annuals coming in. This annual grass is a product of that.
Yeah.
But we don't need to get crazy concerned because it's an annual and we just might not graze that hard next year.
Yeah.
Don't have to worry about it. So we got annuals versus perennials. So some examples of annuals, foxtail, that comes up all the time.
It has foxtail millet, yep.
And that has a big significance for a lot of different critters. Some people hate it. I mean, some people just, you know, from a grass standpoint, they see it in a food plot and they just hate foxtail. And but it, you know, it's an annual grass. A lot of people deal with it. But a lot of people try and have it in, let's say, a wild dove field at the right times of the year. Sandbur, crabgrass is another one that is an annual. And then barnyard grass is another one that's an annual type of grass. So they are producing seed.
Now, barnyard grass is one of Kyle Hedges' natives that he really, really likes, that he mentioned being one of his favorites. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Kyle, if that's not true, but I know you do.
That's one of his.
When I ask him about managing without food plots or without non-natives.
Specifically for doves.
Yeah, that's what he mentioned. So,
So those are just the plants that are producing a seed every single year. And they're not coming back from a root system. That plant dies, seed drops, and then that seed is what's propagating the next year's growth. Simple annual. Perennials. Some examples of those. Broom sedge, smooth brome, switchgrass, little blue stem, river oats.
Mm-hmm.
All those are a perennial base, so they have a root system that lives, it goes dormant. And then it resprouts from that root system the following spring after the winter months. But it still does produce seed heads that can be carried off in various ways. But those are perennials, and you would attack those much differently than you would if you're trying to manage them versus an annual. And there, I mean, these are just small examples of, there's huge, huge lists.
Yep.
So you got annual versus perennial.
Yep.
The next little classification is cool season versus warm season grasses. And I think that this is where people really try and understand plants, whether they are good or bad, let's say. And I think that that can be super misleading because we specifically talk a lot about non-native cool season grasses. And I think that sometimes that might have some, when people hear cool season grasses, that's got like negative undertones because they're so, people often think of, you know, the non-native versions, but there's a lot of cool season native grasses that are good that provide things for wildlife, but then you have warm season grasses. So if I were, you know, what's the definition in your head of cool season versus warm season? It's kind of in the name,
you
but
know,
like,
in layman's terms, it's going to be, you're going to look at a warm season grass being that it's most productive during the warmest time of the year for that climate. So for us, you know, a warm season grass, some of our regionally dominant grasses are going to be coming on in May or June and then slowing down and kind of hitting the end of their cycle in September, October.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the cool season grasses are going to be coming on strong in March. And then, you know, during, they may make seed heads by early summer, and then we don't see much out of them other than a little kind of green clump through the fall.
Tough, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so, do you want me to list all?
I'm going to list some, but
okay.
There's a lot. I mean, you could go through. I think of like bottom ground right now or river bottoms. You go through that stuff. I was in Oklahoma in late November, early December, and there was River Oats and Wild Rise and stuff, like, they were green at the base.
Yeah.
Like, they're not really actively growing right now, but they still were green at the base preparing for next year.
Yep.
So, a couple examples. Cool season grass, tall fescue.
Non-natives. Well, let's break it up into non-native cool season grasses.
I'm going there next.
Okay.
In the breakdown. But you can name them when I
tall fescue.
That one's non-native.
Non-native.
Canada wild rye. Native.
Native. Yeah. My head was going somewhere else when you said tall fescue. So, because there is a native fescue, but
correct.
Tall fescue, specifically the pasture varieties, Kentucky 31,
yep,
is a very common one. But you said Canada wild rye, which is native.
Bottle brush grass.
Native.
Wheat.
So non-native.
Yep.
But
it is a type of grass.
Yeah, it is a type of grass, but it's not really even, like, you don't find a lot of wild, what we all picture as wheat.
Correct.
It's a
hybridized, yeah,
cultivated plant. So
yep, it's not like naturally found growing.
Yes.
And reoccurring, propagating.
Like
itself,
you're
going
to go over
there
to Europe and find wild prairies of wheat.
Yeah. Like, yeah, there are other plants that have the name wheat in them.
Yeah.
That are wild. But this is, we're just talking generic wheat. Because
yeah,
a lot of people, they just don't know that is a type of grass. But it certainly is. And it's a cool season, just like oats would be, just like a rye would be.
Cereal rye.
A triticale.
Yeah. Those are the four big four that you see. Yeah, barley would be another one. So the five and the food plot variety that are most common. All non-native, all cool season.
But like we talked in the definitions, those are the ones that have the grain heads on them. Like,
yep.
That's a characteristic
all
of
annuals.
That definition. Yep. And then smooth brom, which
yeah,
is
non-native.
Non-native.
There
well.
Is a variety of brom. Mm-hmm. I think it's Canada wild brom.
Correct.
That is a native, more in the northern climates. But most of what people find is smooth brom, which is a non-native cool season turf grass.
Then we go into some examples of warm season grasses.
Yeah.
Crabgrass.
Yeah, non-native.
Yep.
There are native varieties of crabgrass, but most people are dealing
with the generic
non-native.
Big blue stem.
Yeah, native.
Indian grass.
Native.
Side oats, grandma.
Native.
And eastern gamma grass.
Native.
And that eastern gamma grass we've talked about is kind of like rides the line of like kind of it's a really early oncoming warm season.
Yeah.
Like it is a fantastic, amazing clump forming grass. It gets super tall. But has thick blades. But I mean,
that's April and May,
yeah,
when it's peaked out, and then it's seed heads by early June, and then it kind of just lays there,
mm-hmm,
and works itself. It's almost like something that comes out and explodes like a volcano. It starts to, yep, kind of like you can just see like everything moving to the side,
and then it gets more horizontal,
and then it just
loses its, yeah, vertical structure, and then
by this time of the year, it's just a big flat thing that looks, mm-hmm, like you walked up to a clump of grass and smashed it right
it's
down.
Like an
it
elephant just, sat on it,
yeah,
pretty much. But it's funny how it all, like, it goes up vertical, and then as it matures, the seed heads begin to fall once it's out past basically its reach,
yeah,
of its own plant to disperse the seed.
Some of the other common ones, Johnson grass being non-native, Bahia,
yeah,
grass non-native,
mm-hmm,
Bermuda grass non-native.
And those are examples now as we get into the native versus non-native,
okay,
grasses.
If you guys
we'll
can't tell,
about.
Matt's looking at the notes. I'm not.
So we've got, that was our second classification, the cool season versus warm season. Now it's very common to go native versus non-native. So
yeah,
examples of native grasses, barnyard grass, little and big blue stem, Indian grass, the side oats, three on.
Yeah, purple three on.
There's a bunch of the ons that are,
yeah,
all types of grasses. They're more in the short grass type prairie,
yep,
or Texas rangeland you think of.
Or glady as all get out.
Mm-hmm. Rocky, shallow,
yeah,
stuff, low moisture.
Side oats grandma would be another,
yep,
one in that.
And then some
blue
non-native
grandma. Going with another. I was,
yep,
just trying to. My mind was racing down all the glady, dry,
gotcha,
nasty climate. All right, non-natives.
But, yeah, those are all natives. So non-natives that a lot we talk about a lot on the podcast, Japanese stilt grass. Well, some people call it Japan grass.
Yep.
Trump probably would.
Yeah.
Goose grass, Johnson grass, tall fescue, Bermuda, and Bahia grass. Those are all,
yep,
non-native grasses. And then the other classification that, like, super easy, anyone could tell this, bunch grasses versus sod-forming grasses.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just the way that they are typically seen growing. Because a lot of these grasses can be rhizome, like rhizomal spreading. So those are
some
more or
less. So native bunch grasses would be like little blue stem.
Yep. Indian grass.
Indian grass. Switch grass. Gamma grass.
Definitely.
And some of your... and then even some of the cool seasons would be considered somewhat bunch grass, like the
wild rye,
bottle brush.
Even river oats, which I don't see it as clumpy as others, but it is considered a clump grass. Those are all natives that are bunch.
And the cool season grass. Mm-hmm. And then you've got native, non-native, or I guess you could say native turf grasses, which... The list isn't, I couldn't just list off, but buffalo grass.
Buffalo is the big one.
And then creeping red fescue would be another native cool season. It's a cool season grass,
but
buffalo grass is a warm season grass, yeah. Buffalo grass is one of those we get a lot of guys ask about landscaping because we talk so much about a lot of our invasive problems coming from the landscaping residential side. And so we've had guys that have landscaping businesses kind of reach out and are like, you know, this is something that I'm looking for, or I'm trying to go into a native approach, and buffalo grass has become a common one, and then, of course, creeping red fescue.
Mm-hmm.
And then even letting other plants kind of designate where it's not big of yards, but that's a whole nother podcast.
Well, I mean, and there's a lot of the native stuff that we're starting to see creep back into the way they should be, but a lot of landscaping stuff.
Yeah.
Blue stems are coming in, and then even river oats I've seen along areas. It's
and
like
some switchgrass.
Pretty, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They
yeah.
really are gorgeous. That's just me talking. But there's a lot of different ways to break those up. But essentially, anyone can get an idea of a bunch forming grass. It's literally a clump that comes out of the ground, usually grows extremely vertical, but it does not spread across the ground and like evenly distribute itself across the top surface. It is in clumps across the landscape.
It does not spread through rhizomes.
Yeah. Whereas sod forming does. It literally is just sod. So everyone can put that together. But essentially, those five ways are great ways that everyone should be considering grasses when they encounter them. Well, which does it fall into here? Which does it fall into this category, in this category, in this category? To be able to then make a management decision of good versus bad. Because all of them do fall into these categories. And then it basically just will dictate for you what those next steps are in the management. So quail, deer, and turkey, all extremely different, right? You've got one bird that's 6 ounces, deer all the way up to, 250 pounds plus.
Yep.
Turkeys right there in the middle, 20 plus pounds. But they all use grasses. They forage differently. Some are ground nesting while others just drop a fawn. They're mammals and birds. Mm-hmm. They just use grasses completely different across the landscape. And then especially throughout the entire year. But what we're going to go into next is breaking down deer, turkey, and quail. And then... essentially, as a grass, or really as any vegetation type, whether we're talking shrubs or trees, our kind of back wall for good or bad, do I keep it, do I leave it, do I minimize it, is what's the cover value for the specific animal we're trying to promote here, and then what is the food value? And that helps determine then, again, what are the next steps? So what we're going to do is go through cover benefits of grass and food benefits for deer, turkey, and quail. Try and break them out the best we can. And then go through the cons. We got to talk about just that's the only way to be fair. We're talking about
pros
grasses.
And cons of these grasses. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So for deer, let's talk cover benefits of grass and what that does for the species, deer in particular, for the moment.
So when I think about grass, specifically native grass, native bunch grass, and it doesn't matter what one, but let's just say anywhere from little blue stem, which is 2-3, sometimes even 4 foot tall, to switchgrass, which could be 7 foot tall.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, I see it around 5 or 6 foot. Is the cover aspect. It can be phenomenal cover during a portion of the year, mm-hmm. and that portion being typically on the cool, late fall, early spring, and of course, winter.
I think of October and November's great months, even sometimes late September in the northern climates as great. Like that's when they're utilizing that type of cover the most.
Yeah, and I think as we get into this too, I want you guys to understand that when you look at cover aspect for specifically white-tailed deer, because so many of our listeners are white-tailed deer fanatics, is all of these, not just the grasses, but then the forbs, the shrubs, the trees. They all play into a puzzle. They're all a piece of that puzzle.
And
you can't have a complete puzzle with just one piece.
Like, we're not going to do cover justice for deer by talking about grasses.
Yeah.
We have to have forbs and shrubs and trees as a part of that. But
if you really want to maximize the cover.
Yeah. If you're planting, let's say, switchgrass for the added benefit of cover to a farm, you're missing out on cover as a whole entire piece of the puzzle for deer.
Yep.
That is a fractional aspect of cover. It can provide some for sure, but you're still going to be missing many windows out of the year if you're trying to lean on one specific vegetation type. But not only one specific vegetation type, it is also one species within that vegetation type.
Yeah,
like you narrowed yourself down to and limited the actual benefit of those acres that, you know, if you're trying to devote them to cover.
I think about
one
this
species.
I think about this a lot too. In fact, today as we prepared for this, you were doing notes and I was doing notes in my head, and I think about it a lot. And when I say society, we'll just say society of land managers, guys who enjoy trying to improve the habitat for wildlife. And I feel like so many times, more times than not, we go against nature's natural cycle. We've talked about this before, but especially not only from planting, but also management. Go into a natural landscape and find even when a storm blew through, and you're going to find trees that got bent over, kind of replicating a little bit of a hinge cut standpoint,
mm-hmm.
or trees that got snapped 10 foot up, trees that got completely blown over, and then other trees that just got left. And then you go into a natural prairie and you're going to find all kinds of different types of plants growing. And you might find a dense pocket the size of a swimming pool that's a monoculture. But you're not going to find vast acres in one type of species or one type of management. And it seems like in society of land managers, we're like, I need to plant a monoculture and I need to hinge cut all things in this area. And we go against everything nature has put forth. And that is just beating, you're pounding sand. Eventually, you're just not even getting anywhere. You may feel like it, but over time, it just, nature does exactly what it wanted to do, diversify the landscape.
Yeah, you have saplings starting to grow into certain areas. I mean, it just begins to take back over, and you feel like
disease
you're losing ground.
Disease kicks in, whatever.
And you the whole monoculture is gone, but... Yeah, you can't, like, I'm all about, and what we talked about at the beginning of this podcast is all about taking the complexities of the natural world that God designed and trying to strip it down into a way that makes sense for land managers, but so much information I feel like is out there that people want to continue to strip down what shouldn't be stripped down anymore. It's like you want to try and make it too simple and too basic, because for some reason, because you just want to go plant something, you just want to go do something, and then it just work. Well, one, that's not how the natural world works.
Play God.
Yeah. But what we're trying to do from a management standpoint and by working with individuals and developing, they're complex management plans, but when we look at like a property in our brains and in the way the natural world works, we have stripped it down to like a lot of the bare bones package of here's what you need to learn and you need to know about your property and its resources. Manage them in these acres in this way. Boom. Do that. Not plant monoculture.
Yeah.
And never touch again. Like, that's just not, you can strip it down and get it way too much bare bones, because sometimes this stuff is confusing.
Yeah, totally.
And don't do yourself and then the wildlife and your property the injustice of trying to strip it down too much, because that's when you continue to just ram your head into the wall and say, be frustrated, and you see the erosion. You see all these disease, you know, species, and you're like, crap.
Or you plant something that you believe to be the best cover possible, and you realize that it's too thick and the deer don't even use it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So, cover benefits of grasses. Let's get back to that.
Cover benefits of grasses. From September, you know, and this all depends on climate or region. In the northern states, you're going to see deer utilize grass stands, and I think that's why switchgrass monoculture has been so popular in the northern states, is because deer utilize those areas more, because you get a wind block and you also still get sun penetration.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's not cloudy, but it is windy and cold, they're going to be somewhere out of the wind where they can collect sun.
Yep.
And they can warm up. And grass does that perfectly.
Yeah.
Especially if it's a taller bunch grass, because they can bed up right against the base of that clump, catch the sun, and be out of the wind.
Totally.
And so that's awesome.
Yep.
But from the flip side of that, if you're in the southern climate or southern United States and you're like, well, I planted this switchgrass. Well, there's no wind going through it.
No.
And it's hot. And the sun still comes in. It's the exact opposite.
Yep.
And so you're like, well, there's no deer out there because there's hardly any shade and there's no breeze and the sun's still shining.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like, yeah, from a standpoint of grass cover, if you're in the southern part of the United States, it would be for that small window of time when it's cold and windy. In the northern part of the states, it's a bigger window of time. Let's say October to even April, if you're way up there, where you need sun to shine and wind blocked. The issue with that is if you're far enough north, you're going to get heavy snows. That's why the diversity of shrubs and trees and evergreens comes into play, because then you have the ability for something to block.
You can't rely on a grass to stand up and much less, you know, more than 3 inches of snow. Yeah. or ice. Like, it just doesn't work.
Yep.
You have to have the complexities of
real wet snow.
Yeah.
Heavy ice, freezing rain. We've seen
fields
of switchgrass. Well, we've seen a lot of the negatives. We've seen in Iowa switchgrass monocultures where deer would not penetrate them, mm-hmm, unless the fringes. Mm-hmm. So basically created living hedgerows for deer. And then we've also seen the standpoint of a field of switchgrass that was completely flattened with a wet snow in January.
Yep.
And so that's why we don't speak too highly about it, because I take it to the bank, there's a better option than going against nature's natural cycles.
Well, and there's a better option, but again, when we're looking at the cover aspect, we're talking, you know, the deer's back is four and a half foot tall off the ground.
Wow.
And so, like, there's some grasses that will never be of cover aspects for deer.
Yeah.
Like Japanese stilt grass. That's not cover. Like, that just, there's no way that grass will be of any cover. Switchgrass, yeah, now we have a height that will hide some deer, but does it really need to be that tall? Most times, no.
Nope.
Because when they bed down, their head's maybe 2 foot off the ground.
Yeah.
2.5 foot. So, mm-hmm, a lot of times, you know, little blue or younger stands of switchgrass or mixtures of all those different types of grasses with the shrubs and with the
forbs.
The forbs all make way more sense for cover, because truthfully too, I mean, switchgrass, if you got 7 foot tall switchgrass throughout an entire field, a deer beds down, if the cover is all the exact same height, then and switchgrass blades a little bit thicker than little blue or big blue or Indian grass. You don't get the sun penetration through there. It's more better at blocking wind. But all these things to say, we just rattled off four or five different types of grasses. And each one of them, although they might have had some things in similar, being warm seasons or more bunch forming, the width of the sheath and the leaf itself was different. So it plays a different role in cover.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just a grass good. Like, you can't boil it down to just that much. You can't just...
It's very hard to simplify land management, especially plant communities, and be successful.
And the key word in that is plant communities.
Yeah.
And that's the backbone of the podcast series, is to say, here's the good and the bad of all these things. We can't rely on all of them individually. We need to rely on all of them working together as a community. And I think if anyone was to hire us or read a management plan that was put together, that from any type of management is throughout the entire plan of communities.
Yeah.
And this works on that, and that works on this, and this works at this time of the year. So you have your bases covered, and you're not just left high and dry at one portion of the year when you really need, this is your stress period, and you haven't covered it. All those things, that's a plant community aspect. Another thing we haven't really mentioned too much is reproduction for fawns. Fawns require different cover. Can you imagine, just a couple hour old fawn trying to get through some rank native grass stuff? It would be very difficult.
Or a rank switchgrass planting.
That's what I'm saying. It's like you couldn't.
I thought the way you said it was native grass, I thought. And so I was picturing a diverse field of grasses, which is still difficult to penetrate. But straight switchgrass, specifically Cavan Rock variety, it is just doggone thick, even hard for a man to navigate through.
Mm-hmm.
And Alamo switchgrass down south, Texas, yep. Oklahoma, in the marshy areas, where it's just like, there, I don't want to walk through that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and like, not to get too much into the weeds, but like, it's a bunch grass, but like switchgrass, it fans out a lot. It's not just like straight vertical. It's not a column. It really fans out. So a couple inches off the ground where a fawn would be laying or they'd be trying to walk through, it's so dense and thick. Like, it does not work that well. So unless that field has been burned or you have discs to try and diversify plant communities and it's growing back at that time frame, it's probably not that much good cover.
Yeah.
So again, it's a plant community standpoint. So cover... There are aspects that grasses do well in a cover. And we have really hung on the warm season grasses. There are some cool seasons we see in bottomlands that if given enough light into those bottomland areas, you can get some good height out of bottle brush or river oats or Canada wild rye, Virginia wild rye, that at certain times of the year, those can be decent cover, too.
We walked a property last week with river oats that were chest high, four and a half foot tall. Now, this little riparian area was getting pretty good sunlight, but there was a spot, I don't know, as big as our backyard or my backyard, that's 50 yards long and then 20, 30 yards wide that was just mostly dominated by river oats.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, lo and behold, landowners said, we jumped deer when we first bought this place coming in here. It's like, I'm not shocked by that.
Right.
Like, where else do you see this kind of cover on the property?
At that height?
Yeah. Still standing here in December?
Late December.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so there are cool season grasses, native grasses, that do really well for that type of cover aspect. It does not just have to be warm season grasses. And I think that a lot of times the grasses get a big highlight, but then warm season from a wildlife aspect get a big highlight too, where cool seasons, natives have their play in everything too.
Yeah.
Whether it's nesting, we'll get into that for other species here, but specifically deer, it has a role, but it's not nearly as strong as a lot of people. We'll get into a little bit of percentage breakdown of like an old field stand of how much grass we would ideally want, or we wouldn't want it to exceed this amount here in a little bit. But what about grass for food benefits for deer.
And that's been one of the biggest, all right, pause for 10-minute rant here, but food benefit from a deer standpoint from grasses is very slim. There's a small group of grasses that deer would eat from the standpoint of just attractiveness. There's some other plants that when green they would eat, but if you see them eating those plants, there's a bigger problem at the farm, because it could be just food is limited so much that they're forced to eat this. And so from a food standpoint of, let's just start with the warm season grasses, and so, since they're the most popular, but switchgrass, there's no forage value to white-tailed deer. Little blue stem, none. Big blue stem, none. Any grass, none. Any of the other little purple on or the grammas, no food value. If you send me a video of a deer eating one, we've got bigger issues. The fact that they're starving. And so,
well, and a
there's
lot of
no,
it,
there's no food value.
A lot so of it comes down to not only the food value, but the actual, like, the structure of the actual plants. Like, when things get to a certain maturity, within grasses, you think about it, like, the leaf material isn't that much of a grass.
Yeah.
Especially something with a lot of vertical height. Like, there's so much lignin content. So that's like the structural component in the cell wall that they can't break that down. They don't have the gut of a cattle. They don't have the gut of bison. So they can't break that stuff down. But
cows don't.
Yeah, they get to a certain
select
point. No,
if you had switchgrass 6 foot tall, sorry, they're probably not eating it.
They're sticking their head or bending it over to get to the very center of that
and
stuff.
And even that, they don't like it.
No. So,
and for example, we've been on properties where Alamo switchgrass was very popular in the wet areas, and they were overgrazing all the other grasses, and the switchgrass was still 6 foot tall.
Not even bothered.
Because they don't want to stick their head in that clumpy grass to eat it.
So,
that's a cow. They don't about eat anything.
Just about. So,
any kind of grass, I should say.
So when it comes to the grasses that deer do eat, it's in a very certain stage of that grass. Specifically, think about wheat.
Yep.
They may eat, and I've seen them, in like the certain stage of seed production, they'll come and eat the actual seed heads.
Yeah.
But the stage between like the bolting stage, when they're setting up the seed head for seed production maturity, they're not eating wheat. It is very, very minimal, but they'll eat it when it's in the grass stage and has just germinated, because the plant itself hasn't matured and has that super high lignin cell wall content. So, like, it is a factor in a food game side of things. But again, most of those grasses that they do forage, it's all a supplemental thing. It's not naturally occurring. At most, I just looked it up on the graph that we commonly use in a report, but at most, the spring is 10% of a deer's diet is grass, at most. Yeah. Doesn't specify which grass specifically, but anyhow.
When is, on that same graph, when is grass higher than 10%?
It's not. Grass was that was the highest, and that was in spring. 10% was the highest. Every other portion of the year is less than that.
Yeah.
So not a very
diet
big factor.
Is at the very highest on grasses is 10%.
I can't tell, but I've seen, again, back to the bottomland stuff, I've seen, you know, the little grass clumps, and some of them obviously have been sedges, but some of them have been like the wild rise being browsed during the spring.
Yeah.
But it's a tiny,
and
tiny
portion.
And
a lot of times that's like when it's limited.
Like, yeah, like that's
where,
like,
where
that's
else
like,
is there food?
It's like when March is like super cold, it's like, please give me something.
They've
else.
Already eaten all the woody browse, and they're like, okay.
Green, I guess I'll get it down.
Yeah.
So it does not have a large percentage of time in which a grass is heavily foraged upon. So essentially, not that it's a zero value, but it is an extremely, and I would
from
I would,
a food standpoint,
say it's extremely insignificant to the entire realm of a deer's diet. So,
if you have a property consisting of a large majority of grass, then you better have the acres that aren't grass better be producing a ton of forage.
A ton, and I know a lot of people are thinking, well, guys, what about, like, you know, I look at Western Oklahoma, Kansas, and Nebraska, and South Dakota. There's parts of there that's just, you know, it's just prairie stuff, and there's lots of grass. Well, Yeah, but what do we talk about at the beginning of the podcast? You walk out in there, there's forbs all over. Like, yeah. That is not just a grassland out there. It is extremely diverse with lots of different types of
and so
forbs.
During the spring and summer, there's tons of food because of all the forbs. But during the fall, that's
shrubs.
Where woody browse. They got to be eating shrubs. And that's where if shrubs aren't on the landscape or 2,4-D has been used a lot and the forbs are removed, that's where you see deer having huge ranges. Or in the winter, you see deer really herding up and moving into cut crop fields where you're like, I'm seeing 100 plus deer because
there's nothing else.
That's
out
the
there
only
now.
Way to survive.
Yep.
So if you're in one of our listeners in Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas, South Dakota, North Dakota, in the plains states, and you're like, man, how can I really maximize this? You got to look at adding the forbs.
Yep.
If you don't have them already. To the landscape, the native forb varieties. And then also you need to look at adding shrubs in a lot of your riparian areas.
Ditches, drainages,
those little coulees
ravines,
to where you have woody browse available.
We still
so
want you to manage with
that's
fire.
Why you see sumac. We see sumac just
hammered.
Browse like
gray
crazy.
Gray dogwood, silky dogwood, red osiers, they're just pounded. Every place we go to that has them, they are torched. So we covered the food cons of grasses. to me, it's pretty easy.
We just said them.
We just said it, exactly.
No food value.
Very little food. And really not much cover value, but specific times of the year and in specific regions of the country. Again, and if we have a field, we don't want excessive amounts of grass in there. So those would be the cons, in my opinion, of a grass specifically for deer. Now, turkey's a whole different ballgame. We're talking vastly different foraging regimes and
different
diets.
Yep.
And the way that they rear young is completely different.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about something that eats insects and not just all plant material.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to cover benefits of grass, what do you think for turkeys?
Know, depending on the time of the year, but pretty good. The issue, once again, would be, is it too rank?
Yeah, for sure.
Is there the possibility of predation on turkeys? You know, in the spring, there's very little value in a dense stand of warm season grass.
Very little.
From a standpoint of, later in the fall, even then, you know.
Usually it's just too rank. It had
it's
too much growth.
Almost always too rank.
Yep.
And so now, from a cover standpoint for wild turkey with grasses, both cool season and warm season, I'd rank it at a 5 or less on a scale of 1 to 10. Because
from cover. Yeah.
For cover value.
I
want it, but I don't want it over a lot of acres. And I would rather have it in a few clumps scattered around mixed with other stuff rather than an entire field of it.
It's funny when, and we'll get into this next week when we cover forbs, but like forbs, because there's a amazing diversity of forbs, but like when you look at grass cover or height that it typically grows in, most things grow 2 foot and higher, between 2 to 6, 7 foot tall.
Yeah.
Forbs, really a lot of the same way. There's some that are low growing to the ground, but most of them fall within that 2 to 7 foot category. And forbs are way easier to traverse and walk. They don't really or typically become super rank where it's just this massive conglomeration where you can't navigate it, unlike grasses. So
yeah,
from this comparison, we're kind of foreshadowing, you'll see a lot more forb-heavy presence from the cover aspect and the food aspects because of those qualities compared to what grasses have or what they don't have.
You just open up a little can of worms. I'll try not to spend too much time on it, but that right there in the definition of what you just said about grasses being a little bit more aggressive or dominant than forbs, where you don't see forbs just like so rank you can't walk through and deer and wildlife aren't utilizing it well. And I think that's what paints a picture of historical landscape with bison herds and herds of elk and deer, which were browsers, which were probably eating more forbs.
Grazers and browsers.
Yeah, yep. And so you had the deer, which were eating a lot more of the forbs, but that never got to a point where they were over over browsing the forbs because the bison herds were also browsing the grasses. So they were constantly both getting knocked back to where you always had a diverse landscape rather than a herd of deer constantly over browsing the forbs where it became too dominated by grasses.
I consistently read and see, and I know you observe it the same way, the same fashion when we're on the road, but states like Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia, a lot of the Mid-Atlantic, there are deer densities that are so extremely high that there is little to zero forest regeneration.
Yep.
And that is extremely damaging, but that's an example right now currently that's happening of too many a herd that is too big that it's, I'm about to cough, hold on. Excuse me. But a herd that is too big that heavily selects forbs and woody browse that is limiting the next generation of those that group of vegetation.
And you throw invasives in on that, and that's just a disaster waiting to happen.
Yes, it is. So, back to grasses, I guess.
Uh-huh. For turkeys?
For turkeys.
Not great, but still, one thing, and I know you're probably thinking about it, so...
Go ahead.
But when you look at it from a standpoint of from nesting standpoint,
yes,
it's important that there are grasses on landscape.
I love
now
to
they
see
can
it.
Still nest in a ragweed or shrub combination, mm-hmm. but having those grasses is good. I like that standpoint. Uh-huh. That's why I like woodlands so much because you can have those grasses intermixed with the oaks. But for a lot of our guys, a lot of our listeners that probably have riparian areas, they're trying to manage a farm that's not got the upland sites, or if they do, it's not allowing it to be habitat. It's not allowed to have habitat improvement done on it because whatever cattle pastures or it's crop fields, and so their woods or their wildlife management is devoted to riparian areas, waterways, lowland forests, and you're going, well, Big Blue Switch doesn't grow down there hardly.
Sure,
unless you're doing Alamo switchgrass or some of these switchgrasses that have a little bit more adapt, they have the ability to adapt to wet feet better. That's where we like those cool season grasses.
For sure.
Like cereal rye, or not cereal rye, Canada wild rye, Virginia wild rye.
River oats,
bottle brush grass. Those four are very common for us to see in these riparian areas, specifically one of the farms we turkey hunt where there's not fields of warm season grasses. There's not CRP. There's not big switchgrass stands. In fact, I'm not even sure I've seen little blue stems scattered around that farm. But those riparian areas, those little bitty
corridors,
waterways, they have those cool season grasses
that
by May are a nice bunch grass knee to hip high.
By May, they're in seed production.
Yeah.
So you've got a grass that through the nesting season
it was
great cover and great structure to be able to hide a hen. And then if she's got the proximity in that specific farm to clover or to other or alfalfa or other forage opportunities, then they're going to do well. They're probably on a repetitive basis, yearly basis, they're probably going to reproduce at a higher rate based on the proximity of those and just the presence of them. The cool season native grasses and the lowland bottomland stuff.
So if you're looking to add cover on your farm and all you have is lowland riparian areas, maybe look at buying some seed that's that river oats or Canada wild rye, Virginia wild rye, bottle brush grass.
Make sure you have sunlight.
And then look at doing a little bit of hack and squirt or TSI and open up that canopy and broadcast it down in the winter and see what happens.
Yep.
And shoot, who knows? Just by opening up the canopy and getting a little bit of sunlight, it may already be there.
It would not surprise me one bit if it was.
Where those areas are the ones that are hard to burn.
Yes.
Because we were in a property in Oklahoma where it had a lot of that in the lowland. And in fact, if there's too much of that, it can create turkeys to leave and go find the short grass over the grazed pastures.
That was an extreme case of dense cover.
Yeah.
But the other areas, from a natural disturbance standpoint, it's going to be tough to burn, but there are, those areas that we're talking about, their disturbance is flooding. Yeah. So at the right times of the year, those are going to flood.
Historically didn't burn much anyway.
Right. So, you know, there's a lots of different disturbances to create this type of habitat that are necessary. But what about food benefits of grasses for wild turkeys?
Absolutely. There's a lot higher value of food than there is cover because they eat little seeds. I've even cut open crops and seen fescue seeds in there.
I've seen fescue. I've seen tons of the
millets, barnyard grass.
I'm trying to think I've seen the goosegrass, crab grasses. I've seen that in there.
Turkeys eat about anything. Yep. And so anything small that they can choke down, they're going to probably eat it. And so I would not be surprised. Now, it's not that I've harvested many turkeys at the time of the year when Indian grass is made seed heads, but I would not surprise me that they do eat some Indian grass or switchgrass, especially because that seed head isn't, it's too tall.
There's a lot of the panicum grasses that quail and wild turkeys are going
eat. And so when he says panicum, that is switchgrass, but it's a family of switchgrass.
It's a broad range.
So panicums, there's a lot of panicums that are native that are knee high.
Deer tongue.
And so you can just, panicums are there's a lot of them out there that provide great food for,
but they all have
turkeys.
A similar seed head size,
little bitty round seeds or oblong seeds that turkeys would definitely eat.
Mm-hmm.
Now I would rather them, and I think that they would as well, rather eat more filling forages, insects, as well as,
well, that's the important aspect of food benefits of grasses. Again, we talked about deer, like they're just herbivores, but turkeys rely on grasses being present in the landscape to then attract other insect life into those areas, specifically grasshoppers, leafhoppers, spiders, all
crickets.
Sorts of crickets, like all sorts of insect life that would be working and relying on some portion of grasses being a part of the landscape there where turkeys are going
and
to forage.
Certain grasses attract certain insects. And the more grass species that you have, the more insects that could be attracted. So,
and same thing with forbs.
Yep, absolutely. You'll hear it next week or whenever forbs is covered.
Back and forth. Cons for grasses.
Too rank.
Too mat forming. Turkeys, I see turkeys in fescue pastures all the time. Especially the spring.
When they're grazed.
When they're grazed. A lot of the hay fields, they're not in it. Yeah. And one, they're just pretty much always a monoculture. But two, it's just because we see them there, that doesn't mean that's where they want to be or need to be, or that fescue pasture can't be improved, because Lord knows it can be for wild turkeys.
Yeah.
But I would say the biggest con is some of them, they're too tall grasses, and then others, they're growing too dense and, like you said, become too rank if not managed appropriately.
Yeah.
I feel like that would be the biggest setback for wild turkeys on this.
I think a lot of guys that ask us why they don't have any turkeys, and it comes down to the property's just too rank, especially if you have a lot of grasses, a lot of CRP. If you're not burning and causing that disturbance, or even mowing as much as, or lightly disking, mm-hmm. as much as I don't like those as much as prescribed fire, if you're not doing some sort of disturbance, I totally would get why the turkeys leave.
Yeah, for sure. So, for sure.
Bob White's?
Bob White's. Cover, benefit of grass.
Oh, it's great from a standpoint of nesting all the way through into the fall. Now, your quail are not going to survive in a field of straight grass.
Never.
And they're not even going to survive during a portion of the year of straight grass. They have to quail are much more dependent on diversity than the turkeys and the deer. They're not as adaptable.
I think I remember this from Frank on a consult. And if I get this wrong, Frank, I know you'll text us, everyone, and embarrass me in our group text. But
yeah.
I want to say that when it came to quail reproduction, there was kind of this like threshold, you know, per acre. We're talking about bunch grasses. I think they said anywhere from like roughly 25 grass clumps per acre was like optimal for, or they didn't see reproduction be compromise with having less than 25 clumps. So if you think of like a broom sedge clump or a little blue stem clump, you only need 25 of those clumps per acre.
Yeah.
And nesting is, you know, going to be successful for quail. So even that aspect, it's like, well, only 25 of those per acre? That's a football field. That's not that much. And that, so from a nesting standpoint, it's important. They have to have it, but not just a complete dominant landscape of that. They need forbs. They need for those chicks to be able to hatch from that clump grass and be able to walk and navigate. So the wind picked up there.
Yeah.
So anyhow, like that kind of gives a for that window, the springtime, for quail specifically, the distribution of grass on the landscape is necessary, but not like an overly huge issue, you know? And then you were talking about going into fall. You're not going to find them a ton of times.
Transition from the grass to more of the woody structures.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like, you know, during the nesting season, yeah, it's pretty important. But that's about the window of time in the whole year where grasses is the main attraction. Where in the fall, woody structure. During the summer, it's herbaceous cover. It's mm-hmm. forbs. And so it's just like, yikes, that grasses really aren't as hyped up. They're really not as good as they've been hyped up to be.
No, not for really any of the species that we've covered today. It's like pretty low value from a cover aspect. And really, from a food aspect too, I don't see there being a ton, like the turkeys, aspect for quail. Now, again, barnyard grass, foxtail, panicum, those types of seed, they are going to be food value.
Yeah.
But a lot of the food value, the higher energy stuff for the winter time frame is all forb production when it comes to seeds. And you look at the seed heads on a lot of the warm season grasses that they would have used for cover at different times of the year. They're windblown, dispersed, very light, fluffy seed. There's not like a let's say a nugget to really get that they can forage on routinely.
Yeah.
So grasses are a key part of the landscape for quail, but seas of grass is still not super important. I mean, I was on a consultation with Frank when we went out to Kansas. The gentleman had CRP that was, you know, had just expired, and I mean, it was grass.
That's a rank. I was just on one last week of
it was extremely
just expired
rank.
CRP and fire. And dormant season disking.
We're part of his gave him basically a bunch of different options, right? He could fire the dormant season disc, or he could during the growing season. Prior to the growing season, burn everything off, and then as soon as it was coming back, spray.
Yeah.
Plateau across it, kill out in some of these strips, kill some of the grass. Like, you have way too much grass. The composition.
What kind of grass was
extremely thick? Anything from Indian grass to switchgrass to little blue, big blue. Like, it was just
plateau, though. You wouldn't be killing it with plateau, would you?
Maybe I'm wrong
on
the plateau.
You were wrong on the herbicide. It was the other herbicide you were talking about. Okay. Because plateau is typically what you're spraying to kill the other stuff to promote those grasses.
Okay. Yeah. I flipped it then. So, but the point was the CRP was way too dense for birds to really be reproducing, foraging, and holding tight. It needed to be broken up to actually increase
any
the
grazing
number of birds.
And was there any grazing
wasn't,
possibility?
Wasn't really open to that.
Okay.
Unfortunately. Gotcha. So that was just a one example of one property. It's like heavy on grass. From a cover and food aspect, it didn't do much. Super low on the forb diversity and composition in those areas. So even for quail, so many people think just grass. Yes. That's not where it's made.
Switchgrass being way too thick, and, you know, our northern guys, hush it. I know. Just stop sending me the nasty email. I know what you're going to say. You're going to say that during the snow, that's where all the pheasants, that's where all the quail go. Well, what else did you give them? That's the only option is switchgrass.
Yep.
And so if in an ideal world.
Or cattails.
World, yeah, or cattails. Or, yeah.
If the Reed's Canary isn't
flat. What's
the
next thing on the list?
Basically, our favorite, least favorites. And I wanted to touch on this just a real quick note. But just like the management of grasses, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, in old fields, if we're talking deer and a wildlife property, we don't want really any more than 40% covered in grass. Like, yes, there's some cover value. different times of the year. I like the structural difference from forbs and from saplings or brambles. But I certainly do not want more than 40%. If I do, we're doing something different to that old field to create diversity among it.
Yeah. And so for me, if grazing is involved, cattle, I still don't even want to go more than 70% grasses, because yeah, I still want to have a wildlife benefit in those. And so it may be 70, but when it gets grazed, it'll kind of open up and create a disturbance. That,
to specify, that is a, you're saying a cattle.
Cattle grazing, yeah.
Well, a cattle, but with a wildlife multi-use property, let's say. Who's not just straight cattle. Because cows have a diverse palate too, right? I mean, they don't just eat grass.
Yeah.
If trained appropriately. But we are obviously removing non-native grasses. You can use, Roundup at the right times of the year, 5% solution or four quarts an acre will do. I think that comes out to actually 2.5.
That's a nice hot batch of glyphosate. A lot of people don't go that hot, but if you're trying to control rank stands of grass, you need to get a little hotter.
Correct. And or clethodim, yep. That's 16 ounces an acre.
Which is about the most common grass-specific herbicide ingredient that people will find in almost any hardware store even. Now, it's a little bit more expensive than glyphosate.
That's right.
But it doesn't take as much.
So favorites and least favorites.
Yeah, favorites for me, and that all depends on the region. But if I go north, I like the switchgrass standpoint.
Like, if you're going to have a grass, I want it. But yeah, I don't want it to be the only thing that's out there in the
landscape. Prairie cordgrass is kind of the wet season one that I would like.
Yep.
So up there. And
you
then,
say wet season, like wet, oh, wet,
wet,
wet area.
Footed, sorry. Yep. Yeah, wet footed. So prairie cordgrass, switchgrass. Mm-hmm. I like broom sedge. And I like little blue stem.
Yep.
Managed appropriately, broom sedge can get a little rank if not managed correctly. Down south, I like, of course, broom sedge and little blue. And then I like bushy blue stem.
Bushy blue stem. Yep. Yeah, no, I'd agree on.
I mean,
those.
I like big blue stem and I like gamma grass. Those other ones rank a little higher to me for just the ability to withstand and are kind of really, really good bunch grasses.
Well, I think so. You named a lot of warm seasons.
I named all warm seasons.
I like, well, what we talked about is from a cool season standpoint, the river oats are honestly just one of my favorites. And those, some people know them as wood oats or inland oats.
Yep.
But those to me are cool. I love like the shape of seed heads and everything. But we see those growing all over the place.
Yeah, and they're not hard to
not hard to propagate. No. Or come across with when you have the right soil moisture, as well
and
as
sunlight.
Yeah, so that's certainly some of our favorites when it comes to grasses. If we're gonna find them on the landscape, those are the ones that we want. But
least favorites.
I know my first one.
I don't like smooth brome tall fescue, in northern climate. Now, I don't like them in the southern climate either, but you typically find them in the Midwest and north. And down south, I can't stand Johnson grass,
Bermuda
grass, and Bahia grass. Those three just drive me nuts. And they're all non-native.
All around, though, what takes the cake for me is the Japanese stilt grass.
Oh, that's a terrible one.
Non-native.
That's the eastern.
And eastern, I mean, honestly, south, we see Arkansas and Tennessee have it. Mississippi's got it bad, but anything there in east is sometimes just covered.
The one that I'm really hating on right now, and just from the standpoint of seeing how invasive it is in the mid-Atlantic and down in the southeast, is Miscanthus sinensis, or Miscanthus Chinese silvergrass, most common name. Mm-hmm. I just can't stand it. I've seen acres and acres and acres just taken over by that, and that one is kind of become a fad of people wanting to use it as a screen. Any of the Miscanthus, and what the Miscanthus gigantus is the one that people are kind of really keying in on as a great screen because it's sterile, and that has a little bit of fear for me from the standpoint of invasive standpoint of there's been a couple of plants that have been introduced as sterile that through time have cross-pollinated with one of their species that they hybridized from. And
correct,
through that cross-pollination became unsterile Bradford pear being the most common.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people say it's sterile, but until it's been planted. Yeah, that plant may be sterile, but its seed or its pollination crossed with one that's not sterile could totally then
create an offspring that becomes extremely invasive, spreads, and has the same tendencies, but reproduces on its own. And
so Miscanthus gigantus was hybridized from common names here, Chinese silvergrass and Amur silvergrass, which is both on the noxious weed list. Chinese silvergrass, highly invasive, and then Amur silvergrass has been considered aggressive through rhizomial activity. That was in from Minnesota DNR. You can look that one up. So two species crossed to create a sterile one. That's a little bit of me going, it's very concerning. 20 years from now, we may say, well, they were right. It was not.
And I would love to be proved wrong on that. I hope the case.
I am wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you better hope that you're right, because if you are wrong, you're going to get an earful from me. I'll be on the biggest mountaintop I can find saying, see, this is why we plant natives. So all those non-natives, because they don't have naturalized or native pests, they get way more aggressive than a lot of our natives. So they become a monoculture pretty quickly.
And I think that, let's just say, let's wrap it up, that overall grasses have a large play in wildlife, but not near the play of forbs, shrubs, and trees that people, you know, would commonly think of. They're overestimated in their value, and I think that by first learning how to identify and break them out, people can then begin to make these same conclusions that we're talking about when it comes to the benefits or the lack thereof of having large portions of properties devoted to just grasses. There is much more to be desired than grasses and
they
grasses.
We're going to flip it 180 next week, but they might be the most oversold, overpushed, overpromoted,
overrated,
and over-discussed plant community or plant field or group of plants with the least amount of production.
Absolutely.
So, like, we hear about them, we talk about them, we see posts about them, we want to plant them, but yet they provide little amount of benefit compared to some of the others.
Essentially, the reason why is because a lot of times they can be propagated. They can be put into a bag and then shipped and sold, and then you can see success, right? You know, it's more difficult to do that with certain trees or shrubs or brambles. Like, when was the last time you saw blackberry seed being sold?
Oh, I'm not sure I've ever seen
that's
it.
That's like, you know what I mean? Like,
native just, blackberry. You can go to a lot of hardware stores and find domesticated ones.
Right. But, like, you can get some maybe potted blackberries, but and we're not suggesting to go and do that and you know, go buy them, because you can get them through other ways of proper management. But we just have got to realize and place value and significance. If the goals are to try and make the property as good as it can be for specific wildlife and their requirements, then we need to know, basically we need to put grasses in their place. And I think that we did that, or tried to paint that picture today of the value that they bring and the value that they don't bring to specific wildlife and just overall land function. We could probably go into further detail about what they do for the land health, which maybe that's another series down the road. But
they do some awesome stuff there.
That's grasses in a nutshell. Next week
in a nutshell. An hour and 10 minutes. 15! We haven't done an hour and 15 minute podcast in a while. Our wives are inside going, my gosh, what's happening? We got another one coming. So jump over and hear podcast number two this week. Guys, we thank you so much. Hopefully you guys are learning from this. We did. I'll say it on the next one.
What?
All right, guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yep. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.